Good. Okay. Welcome back. I hope you had a good lunch. Not too groggy. And I hope this talk doesn't send you to sleep. The title of this talk is The Solar Buddha. Solar as in the sun. And in many ways, it's another kind of take on how we might try to recover the earliest strata of the Buddhist tradition. This morning we looked a little at how it's possible that this idea of the Four Noble Truths, for example, came along at a somewhat later date, that it may not have started out that way at all. And a lot of scholarship that's being done today is slowly beginning to sort of get closer and closer back to the period where the time when the Buddha lived, which is in the 5th century BC, and through textual analysis, beginning to uncover at least anomalies within certain well-established Buddhist doctrines that suggest that there might have been some earlier source. One book is by a man called Johannes Bronckhorst. He's a Dutch-Swiss scholar, and he's published a book which is very revealing on this score called Buddhism in the Shadow of Brahmanism. And his argument, which is the one I'll be referring to in this talk, is that what we know as Buddhism today, and also what we know of the figure of the Buddha, is to some considerable degree refracted through the lens of Brahmanical Hinduism. So this kind of research is trying to sort of uncover what was there before the Buddhist tradition took on Brahmanical elements. And I would argue that one of the Brahmanical elements it took on was a kind of metaphysics of truth. In other words, Buddhism became a competing doctrine in competition with Brahminic and other Indian philosophical schools. I don't want to get too much into that detail. But what I'm going to look at this afternoon is not so much the doctrines, whether or not they're refracted through Brahmanism, but rather the figure of the Buddha himself. And a lot of my work recently has been trying to recover something of this historical person. Now, the reason I'm doing this is not just out of a historical curiosity, but I feel that the further we get back to the source of this tradition, in some sense we recover what is distinctive and radical about its teaching. And my own sense is that we connect with something that's not so much Indian anymore. It's not so tied to the cosmological and religious beliefs of what we think of broadly as Hinduism today. But we uncover something somewhat more primordial. And the reason that I'm interested in that is because I feel that the difference between traditional Buddhist cultures and the worlds in which they lived over the last centuries are very different to the kind of world we live in today. And if we're going to find an authentic Buddhist voice, one that can speak to our condition in the 21st century, it's important, I think, to clarify what it is that is distinctive in a Buddhist voice, that's not, as it were, already been somehow compromised by its involvement in Indian religion and philosophy and epistemology and so on. And the way that we can start to get back to some of this early material is by dissecting some of the stories that occur in the canon often quite marginal events concerning characters we've probably not heard of. And in some ways, they just serve as a kind of theatrical backdrop to the suttas, to the discourses. And when we read the Pali Canon, often what we look for is the Dharma, the teaching. And so we read a text and it says the Buddha was staying at this place and he was accompanied by this person, and then this person came along and asked him a question, and we think, you know, come on, get on with it. I wonder, what does he say? And we often ignore that material and focus in on the actual, the meditation instruction or the teaching about dependent origination or whatever it is. But recently, I've been much more interested in trying to discover what's going on in what looks like the theatrical backdrop. And here's an example of that. It concerns a man called Mahanama, who was the Buddha's cousin on his father's side, and was the person who basically took on the job that the Buddha would have had had he not left home. You know, he was basically the leading son of one of the leading figures in Sakya and Kapilavastu, and the idea is that, you know, probably he would have been the one who would have been the leader of the community. But after he left home, that job fell vacant, and Mahanama is the one who took it up. And so we can reconstruct quite a detailed picture of this man Mahanama's life. So this is a sutta. It's in the Samyutta Nikaya, and it starts with Mahanama coming to the Buddha, and he says, "This Kapilavastu is rich and prosperous, crowded with congested streets. In the evening, when I enter the town after visiting the Buddha or worthy bhikkhus, I might encounter a runaway elephant or horse, a chariot or a cart that's gone out of control, or a man who's gone berserk. This disturbs my mindful recollection of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the community. And it occurs to me, if at this moment I should die, what would be my destiny? What would the future hold?" Now, what I like about that sort of passage is that it throws us right into a human world, one that we can probably identify with quite easily. Here we have a man who has a position of responsibility in the community. He also has a spiritual side. He enjoys studying, he enjoys meditating, he enjoys spending time with the Buddha and his monks. Yet when he comes home in the evening, the world is revealed once again to be a dangerous and a precarious place. And the Buddha replies to him, "Do not fear, Mahanama, do not be afraid. Your death will not be a bad one. A noble follower who possesses four things, slants, slopes, and leans towards nirvana." What for? Here, Mahanama, a noble follower has lucid confidence in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the community. He possesses the virtues that are dear to the noble ones. Suppose a tree were leaning towards the east. If it were cut down, in what direction would it fall? And Mahanama replies, "In whatever direction it was leaning, sir." And Gautama says, "So too, Mahanama, a noble follower who possesses these four things slants, slopes, and leans towards nirvana." And then he goes on to say that, you know, you don't have to worry about dying. That you are a person whose mind slants, slopes, and leans towards nirvana, just as a tree leaning to the east would fall in the east. So when you die, your mind will incline and fall towards nirvana. And he describes a person who has such a mind, as one who has lucid confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and fourthly, possesses the virtues that are dear to the noble ones. Now, we know from other passages that that is the classical definition of what's called stream entry. And in other words, a person who has dedicated his or her life to living in a way that aspires to be more awake, which is really what it means to have confidence in the Buddha, means to have confidence in one's own capacity to be more awake and alive in that sense, has confidence in the Dharma, which are the teachings and the practices that contribute to such an awakening, and has confidence in the community of those who support us or him or her in that process. And in addition, is the sort of person who has dedicated his life to cultivating the virtues that go along with this kind of living. Now, this is, I think for many of us, automatically we recognize this has to do with what we call taking of refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And nowadays, that's very often thought of as the sort of entry ritual to becoming a Buddhist, is you take refuge. But here, we're at a time before Buddhism becomes a formal religion. And this idea of confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is not to be thought of as some kind of entry into a religious belief system, but it is really a way of talking about how one's mind can change course from simply being concerned with one's own self-interest, concerned with, you know, getting rid of what one doesn't like, getting what one wants, refining and celebrating one's ego, as we talked of this morning, and instead consciously makes a commitment to center one's life around what we might call higher values. And in Buddhism, these are the values of awakening, of the Dharma, and of the Sangha, or the community. So Mahanama, therefore, is understood as someone who has entered the stream of the path, and who has living a life of confidence in these values, and is working towards realizing the kinds of goods and virtues that are involved in this process. So again, this already, I think, gives us a glimpse of a world in which ordinary people who are very involved in the world, and Mahanama had a lot on his plate, and I can't go into the whole story, but the kind of the kind of insights, the kind of position he has in the community is one of someone who's a genuine part of the Sangha, of the community. He's internalized these values, and yet at the same time he's aware of his own human frailty. He's anxious when he goes back home at night and sees wandering people, crazy people walking around the street, runaway horses, whatever it might be. So he's afraid. And the value of this, I think, is to point out how we tend to idealize spiritual attainment as something that puts us on a sort of other level or on a kind of plateau of enlightenment in which all of our habitual worries just sort of evaporate and disappear. And what the Buddha is saying to him is that, look, even though you do suffer from anxiety and fear and troubles in the world, nonetheless, in the core of your being, you are inclining, or as he says, sloping, leaning, and slanting towards nirvana. So this very much locates the practice in the life of people who live fully in the world. Okay, another passage. Now, this also takes place in Kapilavastu, which is the town where the Buddha grew up. And it says, on that occasion, this is Majjhima 53, the Sekha Sutta, on that occasion a new assembly hall had been built for the Sakyans. And it hadn't been inhabited by any wanderer or Brahmin or person at all. And following the customs, the Sakyans invite the Buddha to inaugurate the hall. So he agrees to do this. And then in preparation, it says they covered the floor of the hall with carpets. They prepared the seats. They put out a large water jug. And they hung up an oil lamp. And when Gautama arrived, he washed his feet and then entered the hall and sat down by the central pillar facing east. The bhikkhus sat behind him along the western wall facing east, and the Sakyans of Kapalavatthu sat by the eastern wall facing west with the teacher before them. Mm-hmm. Now, what is strange, I think, for us is, why all the detail about the seating arrangement? It's very odd. And it's the sort of text that you would usually just scan over and think, this is crazy. You know, why do I need to know this? And the Buddha then gives a talk, and then he gets tired halfway through. His back starts to hurt, so he lies down. And then Ananda picks up the discourse and addresses Mahanama the Sakya, the same person, Mahanama. Mahanama, therefore, is sitting amongst the Sakyans in the east, and the Buddha is looking in that direction. Now, I personally feel that this is pointing very much towards how the Sakyans were, as many agriculturalists of that period, everywhere in the world, revered the sun. And they, according to some sources, the Sakyans actually believed that they were descended from the sun, a bit like the Japanese believe that their emperor comes from the sun. It's a very traditional belief. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we have, on the one hand, the Buddha facing the east, where the Sakyans are seated in the position of the rising sun. And when he talks to Mahanama and says, don't worry about dying, just as a tree leaning to the east will fall that way, so you, a person who's committed himself to these values, will also incline to nirvana. Now, what's interesting about this is that nirvana seems to be understood here through the metaphor of the rising sun. So we have here a community and a culture that is essentially a solar religion, a worshipping of the sun. And it's not, therefore, and this is, I think, the important point, it's not, therefore, a Brahmanical society. It's often thought that Buddhism starts as a rejection of Hinduism, or Brahmanism, as it was called then. The Buddha rejected the idea of a creator god. The Buddha rejected the idea of an eternal soul, an Atman, and the Buddha rejected a society that was divided according to caste. And it's usually understood that this is because he came from that sort of society, and his enlightenment somehow revealed the iniquity of that kind of way of life. He rebelled against it, and he introduced Buddhism. But actually, that might be all completely wrong. And what these texts, these little snippets and fragments of text, suggest is that we're not in a Brahmanic society, but we're in a pre-Brahmanic society where the people are still essentially agriculturalists whose primary focus of worship is not Brahman or God or an eternal soul but the Son. And likewise, it's not a society that's divided according to caste. The Buddha didn't grow up in a caste-based society. The Brahminic norms of those kinds of beliefs had not yet been established in the parts of India where the Buddha lived and taught. This is the thrust of Bronkhorst's book, if you want to read about this further. So, again, another text which reinforces this. This is from the Sutta Nipata, which is one of the earliest parts of the Pali Canon, and it talks of the Buddha's renunciation, of his leaving his home, and he arrives at a town called Rajgir, and there he meets the king, a man called Bimbisara. But this is before the enlightenment, before he becomes the Buddha. But the king is curious about this young man who shows up, and he asks him who he is. He says, "Who are you?" And this is the Buddha's, or the Buddha-to-be's, reply. He says, "There is a people, king, living on the flank of the snow ranges, endowed with wealth and energy, belonging to the land of Kosala. They are of the sun lineage, Aditya Gota, Sakyans by birth." So here we have a very explicit, probably the only explicit recognition that the Buddha sees himself as belonging to the lineage of the sun. And what I think is to me particularly striking about this is that his teaching, therefore, is not based on a reaction against something else. He's not reacting against Brahmanism and developing an alternative. He's actually taking his solar culture and universalizing it. The sun is not, sun worship is not rejected. But what he does is he takes the actual physical sun and turns it into a metaphor for nirvana. Now, this again is not common in much Buddhism today. Buddhism often presents nirvana as being like the moon. It's a kind of cool light. Whereas here, quite clearly, I think, nirvana is compared to the sun. And his practice, therefore, is one that transforms this solar worship, this animistic culture, if you like, into a universal way of living in the world, no matter what particular background you might have. So he universalizes the imagery of sun worship. So in other words, it's a very positive development of an earlier tradition, rather than a reaction against, in this case, a Brahminic tradition, in which it's always in conflict. I don't want to get into the history of when the Brahmanism began to enter in and so on. Now, this also points to the fact, or at least to the possibility, that the Sakyans were not actually descendants of the Aryans, that they may have actually been part of the indigenous population of that part of India, that they didn't come loaded with the idea of being the people who had come in and dominated the Gangetic Basin and established their form of Brahminical worship. It could be that the Sakyans were the local people. Now, to give some further illustrations of how this begins to pan out, I'd like to jump to another text. And this concerns what happens after the Buddha's enlightenment. We've seen him come down to Rajgir. He's told Bimbisara that he belongs to this sun lineage. He then goes down to Uruvela, which we now call Bodh Gaya. And it's at that point he gains his enlightenment, his understanding, his awakening, whatever we call it. And he then heads back to Rajgir, which is in the east. But if you read the actual account in the suttas, that's not what he does. According to the suttas, he doesn't know what to teach after he's had his awakening, and he sits around not knowing what to do, and then suddenly Brahma appears, the god Brahma. And Brahma says, you know, there are people with little dust in their eyes. You should teach the Dharma to them. And so the Buddha thinks of, well, who could I teach? And he thinks, well, there's these five ascetic companions, all of whom were Brahmins. I'll go to Varanasi, to Benares, where they are, and I'll teach them. Now, all this passage does really is to subordinate the Buddha to the Brahmanic tradition. In other words, Brahma basically tells him what to do. He then goes off and explains himself to the Brahmins in the holy Brahmin city of Benares. Now, that's the standard narrative. But the problem is that to do that, he had to make roughly a 400-mile detour. He had to go all the way to the west, teach the first sermon, and come all the way back. Because the texts quite clearly say that he goes to Varanasi, then he comes back from Varanasi. That's 400 miles, roughly, just to give a talk. It seems unlikely. It seems more likely that he, after the awakening, he headed back to Rajgir, which was the main capital city of its day. He already had this connection with the king, and we know from the suttas and the Vinaya particularly that that's where he then established his first centre, not in Varanasi, but in Rajgir, in the east. But on the way, he encounters a bunch of matted hair fire worshippers. These were people who basically were, again, something like the solar worshippers, but these people actually worship fire itself and not the sun. And they were adepts, it seems, in controlling the fires. Maybe they meant also the inner fires, I don't know. But in any case, my own view, which is of course perhaps wrong, is that the Buddha did not go to Varanasi. He did not give his first teachings there, but instead he started dealing with the local shamans and gurus, who were called the Kasapa brothers. There were three of them, and they were all fire worshippers, and they all had knotted hair on their head, and they had a fire room in which there was not only fire, but there were also snakes. Again, this morning we've already touched on all of this, all of this imagery. And I'm not going to go into the details, but basically he persuades these fire worshippers that he's actually onto something more important. And this then leads to his going a little bit further north to a place called Gaya Sisa, Gaya Hill, which is, you can still see it in Gaya today, near Bodh Gaya. And on the top of that hill, he then gives what I think is his first discourse, and that's what's called the fire discourse or the fire sermon. And it's there that he does something very similar to what he did with the sun. He takes the sun as a physical reality and begins to think of it as a symbol for nirvana, and he takes fire in this first sermon as a symbol for reactivity, for greed and hatred and delusion. And you're probably familiar with this text, if not from the Buddhist sources. It's quoted in T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. But basically the Buddha is saying everything is burning. The world is burning. The senses are burning. The body is burning. The feelings are burning. The mind is burning. Okay, so he takes the idea of fire, but reads it as a metaphor for the condition in which we as human beings are aflame. And he says, burning with what? Burning with greed, burning with hatred, burning with delusion. It's burning because of birth, sickness, aging and death, sorrow, suffering, lamentation and despair. The world is on fire. And his teaching, therefore, is one that seeks to come to terms with this burning condition, not by doing rituals and rites as these fire worshippers would have done, but turning our attention inward to what is actually going on in our own experience, which he compares to fire. We looked at this morning, I don't need to say much more. But basically, reactivity is when we flare up. We flare up with attachment, with hatred, with narcissism, whatever it might be. And the practice, therefore, is to understand that, to acknowledge that that's what's happening, and not to feed it, not to exacerbate it, not to make it, as it were, even more aflame. And so he describes in the fire of discourse how our life blazes and overheats. And that's kind of the first step to begin a process that he then describes quite succinctly but quite clearly as a process of mindful disengagement. In other words, as we observe what's going on in our experience, we also gain a certain distance, a certain recul, a certain stepping back. And this, I think, is a way of talking about what we do in meditation, is we step back, metaphorically. We're still in the same body, we haven't gone anywhere. But instead of being caught up in this stuff, we step back and we just notice what's happening. We notice what's going on. And it's this kind of disengagement that leads to a sort of stillness, a quiet, a certain dispassion, if you like. And that, in turn, leads to the awareness that one is free. In his language, it's and this leads to the awareness, I am freed. So in other words, the practice of meditation here is about withdrawing in order to see what is going on. And in that engagement, in that mindful attention, there we discover that we have the freedom not to get caught up in the cycles of this flaring reactivity. And that, of course, is the experience of nirvana. Now, nirvana is simply described as the ending of greed and hatred and delusion. But I don't think this means that at that moment they literally come to a stop and they never occur again. But rather we get a glimpse, as it were, of another set of possibilities. The possibilities that are then articulated in this idea of having confidence in awakening, confidence in the Dharma, confidence in the community. We cultivate the virtues which are dear to the noble ones, which is what he calls entering the stream of the path. So this nirvana allows us, as it were, another way of seeing the world. And in that sense, this experience of nirvana is illuminating. It's illuminating in the same way that the sun is illuminating. And so I'm not sure about this, but I get the sense that he's basically discovering a source of a far brighter light than that of mere fire. Remember, both fire and the sun are sources of light. And they're both fire, basically. Of course they are. And what he's doing, therefore, is pointing to these fire worshippers that there is actually a much greater light within yourself, in which you can then which then illuminates a whole other way in which you can be in the world as a human being, a whole other way in which you can flourish. And it's interesting in the Four Noble Truths / tasks that when he describes the third task, remember the first task is to embrace or understand the world, the second is to let go of reactivity, in other words, just let it burn itself out. The third task is to behold the ceasing of reactivity. And the ceasing of reactivity is synonymous to nirvana. And nirvana is something to be beheld, something to be seen. It's an experience that he's encouraging us to actually affirm and valorize at each moment when we're, as it were, aware that this flame state has died down and that we're still and we're present with what's in front of our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our body, our minds. Nirvana is associated, therefore, with an ability to see more clearly, an ability to behold what's going on. Now, in this sense, nirvana is not just an absence. It's not just the snuffing out of greed and hatred and delusion. But it's actually to be understood as access to another kind of illumination, another kind of light that illuminates the world, a light like that of the sun. And another indicator of the centrality of this is that throughout the Buddha's life, he's actually known as the Adichamita, which is Pali for the friend of the sun. Adichabandhu means the relative of the sun. In other words, he never rejects the association of himself or his teaching with that of the sun, except the sun now has become nirvana, this inner light, if you wish, rather than the actual physical object in the sky. But if we begin to unpack the metaphor, the sun does two things. It gives both light and it also gives heat. It's warm and it's illuminating. And it seems that these two would correspond quite neatly to the values that we find in Buddhism of wisdom and compassion, or understanding and love. There's something about nirvana that affords us an access not only to light or illumination or wisdom, but also it opens up the possibility of a kind of inner heat or warmth, which we might understand as kindness, love, compassion. And the beauty of the metaphor is that the sun does both at the same time. We don't have to think of two separate functions. Light and heat are inseparable. So in this sense, the nirvana is not a sort of detachment or cutting off from the world, the suffering world, but it is actually a metaphor for a much more total engagement with life, both in terms of how we understand it and in terms of how we are emotionally involved with it. But these are not the understanding and the emotion that are merely the flaring up of reactivity, opinions, or attachment to something, but a much more transcendent kind of way of life that enables us to flourish more fully as human beings. Now, there's another aspect of the sun, I think, we can also think of, and that is the sun is a metaphor of selfless generosity. Now, I mean, the Buddha may not have known this at his time, but we now understand that the sun is basically basically giving itself away. Because the sun is burning itself out without any, obviously there's no sense of agency involved, it's not doing this for any purpose, but nonetheless it's an image of a kind of selfless giving of one's life away. And that, I feel, is again very, very much at the heart, particularly when we reach some of these Mahayana Buddhist ideas of the bodhicitta, of aspiring to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. That's a very solar image. It's an image in which you dedicate your life to the welfare of the world. It's a very powerful metaphor of that, and it's a very powerful metaphor of a life based on giving rather than a life based on holding on or grasping. It's a giving away. And finally, another way in which the word, the image of the sun is used in these early texts is as a metaphor of the for the teacher, or as they say in Pali, the Kalyanamita, which means the good friend. The Buddha doesn't say a great deal about the role of the teacher in the early texts. But on the few occasions he does, on at least two of them, he compares the good friend, the teacher, as the one who is like the rising sun. He says, just as when the sun arises from the east and it casts its light and illuminates the landscape, so the role of the good friend is one who illuminates the Noble Eightfold Path. So the word teacher is not used. There is another word in Pali for teacher. What the Buddha seems to think of as the role of the person who helps others is more akin to a sort of friendship, mita, mitra. And this kind of friendship is one that has the purpose of showing people the way, illuminating the path like the sun's rays illuminate a landscape. And this brings us back to where we started, that the Buddha assures Mahanama that he is one whose mind slants, leans and inclines towards Nirvana, which is the definition of a person who has entered the Eightfold Path, has entered the stream. Their mind is, their life is now leaning in that way, inclining in that way. And one of the characteristics of a person who has entered that stream is that he or she has become autonomous. The term in Pali is aparapachaya. That such a person is no longer dependent on others in the teaching. The role of the friend, the good friend, is to not make you dependent on him or her, but in order to get you to stand on your own feet. That's the purpose of the teacher. The teacher is to helps you find the path, but once you find the path, you achieve or discover your own autonomy and your own authority. So in other words, if it's compared to the sun, it's also like the sun's light and the sun's warmth enable other organisms to grow. And that, I think, is a very beautiful metaphor of the role of the teacher. It's to empower others. It's, in a sense, to get rid of students. It's to get people to find their own authority, to cultivate and to develop their own way of life, but a life that's also embedded within a community. The two ideas are not in conflict. That the sort of community I think that the Buddha envisages is one of self-actualizing individuals who support each other in each other's process of self-actualization. It's not about getting rid of self. It's about cultivating and developing what is characteristic of your own particular life in such a way that you individuate, in such a way that you're supported in that process through supportive friendships and relationships. But the point of the community is not that everybody gets to believe the same things and to hold the same opinions and to perform rituals and other practices together and feel as though you're part of a club, but actually it's a community that celebrates individual difference. And it may meet, like we're meeting here today, or on a retreat, or at the Buddha's time during the monsoon period, but this is seen as a temporary gathering, a gathering in which you get together with people of like mind, you support each other in your practice, but then you leave and you go back into the world. And I think one of the most beautiful stock phrases in the early texts is this injunction that the Buddha gives. He says, go forth into the world for the welfare of the many, for the benefit of the many, and let no two of you follow the same path. Wow. It's very much about going forth into the world on your own, in your own way, anonymously perhaps, not carrying a Buddhist flag, but just going into the world to do good. In whatever circumstance you find yourself, whether you're Mahanama running your community, or whether you're a doctor, or whether you're a monk, or whatever it might be, the purpose of the community was to wander, to engage with the world, not to lock yourself behind monastery walls. The Buddha certainly didn't intend that at all. So I think on the basis of some of these texts that we've looked at, and some of the interpretations that I've risked around them, and also in terms, of course, of scholarship like that of Bronkhorst and others, is that we begin to get in touch with a teaching that's not just a bunch of doctrines or theories, but it's actually a model for a way of life, both an individual life and a communal life, and it's premised on very naturalistic metaphors, particularly the metaphor of the sun. And the Christian theologian Don Cupid, who some of you might have heard of, has also come up with a very similar vision for Christianity. He talks of solar living, in which you, as it were, live a life in which you give yourself away. Now, he arrived at that quite independently of knowing anything about Buddhism, certainly not this early Buddhism. But I sent him some of this information, and we've talked about it. In fact, we were talking about it on Friday in Cambridge. I went to have tea with him. And one of the things that both of us have found very inspiring is an image that is here in the British Museum, in the room with all the Indian antiquities. It's a bas-relief, a piece of probably clay, I think, or it might be stone or some soft stone. And it's a very early representation of the Buddha, but in a non-human or a non-iconic form. It's about this big, and it has... actually, I've got an image of it here. Can you see?
Yes.
You see it? I'm turning it around so it doesn't reflect.
The sun.
It's the throne on which the Buddha was sitting, and there are two attendants. Above it is the Bodhi tree. I'll leave it down here, you can come and have a look. And on the throne is just an image of the sun. A very stylized image of the sun. And this again is indicative of the culture, the Buddhist culture after the Buddha's death, in which the Buddha was never represented as a human being, but only by symbols, footprints, a stupa, which is like a tomb, the Bodhi tree, and this is the only example I've seen, but also as the sun. And Don Cupid has this on his mantelpiece now, this picture. So also, it perhaps is a way of, you know, bringing together elements of our own Christian culture, elements of a Buddhism that is, in a sense, pre-Buddhist in many ways. But I think it's an imagery and a model and a vision that addresses our condition in a very direct way, without reliance upon having to hold any metaphysical beliefs, beliefs in rebirth or the doctrine of karma or realms of existence or the cessation of suffering or any of these things, or craving being the origin of suffering. All of that can be politely just put to one side. And in its place, I think we have a source of material here that can perhaps become a basis or a foundation for another way of doing this practice, another way of understanding what the Buddha was trying to communicate. Okay, it's 3:00. We'll stop here. And